In Mark chapter 7, last week we talked about the discussion that Jesus had about the idea of defilement. Very specifically, a kind of religiously charged word, perhaps, having to do with sacrifice and atonement and so forth. But we move this week from a discussion of that to Jesus' healing power. Seemingly somewhat of an abrupt change in Mark's narrative. Okay? And we come to this particular occasion when Jesus encounters what Mark calls a Syrophoenician woman by birth. Matthew calls her a Canaanite. And his interaction with her is very perplexing. From what we know about Jesus, it doesn't seem to fit with who we know him to be. And then, of course, we have this healing of the deaf man, which is done in a kind of an unusual way. He doesn't just lay his hands on them, not just by a simple word or a gesture. He takes them aside and uses some other seemingly innocuous or unnecessary means, knowing what power Jesus has himself. What are we to make of these things? Okay? And I suppose this is one of those occasions where we have to sort of preface our remarks with saying, nobody said understanding Jesus was going to be easy. He doesn't always fit our mold of things. But he does tell us some things in his behavior, and I think that's what we try to learn today. There are some details and questions raised about these healings that we want to go along with today. Now, you may want to note, if you want to stick your finger in another passage, Matthew chapter 15, verses 21 through 28, also gives details about this woman. Okay, and he gives a little bit different detail, which I'm going to mention as we go along. You won't necessarily have to follow it, but if you kind of listen, you'll be able to catch what I'm trying to say. The very first thing that jumps out at us in this particular occasion is that it seems that Jesus actually snubs this woman. Okay? He ignores her. He does not treat her very well, which seems very much out of character. Now, Matthew calls her a Canaanite, which is kind of interesting. That's even, to me at least, a little worse than saying she's of Syrophoenician birth. The Canaanites were clearly always against Israel during their history. They were the ones whom the Israelites went to follow after their gods. And so very clearly from the standpoint of a Jewish person, they were the ones who polluted their land. Now, you know, the Jews had to say at least honestly, well, we didn't have to listen to them. But he uses that particular term. And when she begs for Jesus for mercy in Matthew's account, not only does it say that, you know, he doesn't answer her, he actually seems to be snubbing her. He does not even offer her a word when she comes after him. And the disciples keep telling him, can you get rid of her? She's being extremely disruptive. Jesus just ignores her. Doesn't say a word to her. And it seems very callous, doesn't it? That does not fit what we believe Jesus to be. He tells her she has no right to eat at the table. You know, it's also kind of unlike his encounter with the centurion, who also was a Gentile, Matthew chapter 8, verses 5 through 13, whose great faith was better than what he had found among his own people. And furthermore, he has already noted in the early part of his ministry in Luke chapter 4, verses 25 through 27, that during the time of Elijah and Elisha, both of them went and healed people who were not even of the nation of Israel. So what's going on here with Jesus? Why is he doing this? And not only that, he's just finished challenging the Pharisees that they were far from God in their hearts. They didn't seem worthy of being God's children. So once again, why do something that seems so out of character here? We'll try to give some observations in a moment, but let's take a look at the second healing, the healing of a deaf man. In verse 32, it says that people wanted Jesus to lay his hand on the person. That's all they wanted. And in Matthew's account, by the way, after he tells the story of the Syrophoenician woman, or the Canaanite in his translation, Matthew just doesn't note this particular individual, but he notes that there's a lot of people that Jesus is healing. he goes to this other particular region, and it says there's people coming to him all the time, and they're bringing everybody to him. Mark brings out this one individual. He kind of personalizes this little story here, which is maybe part of the interesting insight to this. But the fact that they wanted him to lay his hands on the man tells us something that they knew about his power. They were not unfamiliar with it. Now, if you remember back in Mark chapter 5, by the way, Mark notes here that he goes into the region of the Decapolis, which is a region on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. Okay. Now, he's been there before. You remember the story about the man with a legion of demons, and he told the demons they could go into the swine? When the man wants to go with him, Jesus says, go back and tell everybody how much God has done for you. You know where he went? He went into the region of the Decapolis. So people are familiar with him here. He's kind of in, at least on the border of Israel, he's sort of almost into Gentile territory. So there's sort of this beginning to blend, sort of like an estuary where you begin to blend the salt water with fresh water coming out of the river. Okay, this is kind of where he is. And Gentiles are there. Okay, but the interesting thing here is that, among other things, Jesus takes the man privately. Now here's a guy who's deaf, so any conversation is already private, you know? I mean, he can't hear anybody. So he's in this private little world of himself. But it's what Jesus does here that's kind of unusual. It says he puts his fingers in his ears. He spits. What's that all about? What's the spitting for? Does Jesus need to spit in order to heal somebody? And he utters an Aramaic phrase that Mark has to translate for us to affect the healing. Well, why not just say a word? Why not just lay his hand on the man or let him touch his garment? We don't have any certain answers for that. I don't. I'm really not sure that I can give you an answer. What I can give you are some observations about the passage that perhaps help us a little bit understand Jesus himself. We do not know the mind of Christ in many occasions, nor do we know the mind of Mark in arranging the material the way he does or in giving us the particular events that he does. Remember, Matthew doesn't give this particular person. He doesn't tell us about this particular individual. All he says is a lot of people came to him for healing. But I think we can still learn some things here. And I think that's what's important. Here are my observations. Let's go back to the woman and her daughter. Again, we don't know what Jesus' motivation is here. Some say this was a lesson for the apostles. He intentionally snubs her to make a point of her great faith. He knew somehow she was going to say what she said about the dogs eating from the table. Okay? Remember, he's very specifically in Gentile territory here. He's up near Tyre and Sidon, which would have been outside the borders of Israel. We don't know why he was there to begin with, but that's maybe one of the interesting questions. Some suggest he's testing her faith, which doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because she seemed to already believe that he could heal. That's why she's there. She's begging for him to heal her daughter. But the point about who gets fed first seems very significant. Both Matthew and Mark mentioned this. That seems to be a significant theological feature here. And the theological priority of Israel kind of takes center stage here. You kind of have to set aside the way Jesus is dealing with this and look beyond the fact that he seems to be snubbing this woman and treating her very poorly. She's like a dog and you don't feed the dogs. That's what he's telling her. So this particular theological priority for however he's handling it seems to take center stage, as it did when he talked to the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4 and verse 22. He says salvation is of the Jews. He wants that point to be made. Does Mark put this here to demonstrate Jesus' theological orthodoxy? Perhaps. You know, especially after his criticism of the Pharisees. they might have been able to say, well, he's just so far out there in left field, we don't even have to listen to him at all. We don't know why he's in Tyre and Sidon in the first place, of course. And I cannot explain to you why he is so rude to her. There may have been a better way to handle this. The observation that I can get that seems consistent with his work is very simply this. Jesus is, first and foremost, the Messiah to the Jews. If he is not their Messiah, he's not our Christ. That's very, very key to Jesus' work. It's a key to the theology in the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans when he spends a great deal of time, several chapters, trying to explain how that the Jews have not been ignored. Doesn't seem like they're accepting much, but he says they have not been ignored. In fact, some of what I've been reading recently suggests that when the gospel got out further into the Mediterranean world and the known world, you know, that in fact there were an awful lot of Jews who did accept it. Okay, so that's another issue. But the fact is, he is their Messiah first and foremost. He has to satisfy all of those things in the Old Testament in order to be our Messiah. Again, I can't explain to you why he does this to her, but he does. You know, he does at least allow her to appeal to him, doesn't he? He allows her to change his mind. That's maybe significant. Maybe that's the most significant feature here. He allows her to make an appeal to him and change his mind. Well, how about the healing of the deaf man? He leaves the region of Tyre and Sidon after this woman, goes to another area on the edge of Israel's border. Remember the demoniac, he's in the Decapolis here. But he takes this particular man and he takes him privately. Okay? And he counsels him and others to speak this to this of no one. Of course, they can't keep quiet about it, verses 36 and 37. But he takes him privately. He deals with the guy one-on-one. Now, that might be a very significant feature here as well. You know, these little details that the writers put in, they're not insignificant details. They're important. And they tell us something. Maybe it's difficult to actually figure out exactly what they're telling us, but I think this is a very significant one. And of course, counseling others, you know, don't go tell anybody about this after he's dealt with this. He's in their presence. I don't want you to go tell anybody. This is between you and I. That's a very intimate kind of thing, isn't it? Now, admittedly, they don't listen to that. Who could? You know, I mean, these people are being healed. This guy's been deaf. He can't speak. And now he's got both of those faculties back perfectly. How can he not speak? Well, the fact is, he doesn't, and he just goes out and he kind of disobeys Jesus. The key, I think, maybe is what Matthew says in Matthew chapter 15 and verse 31. Again, Matthew doesn't necessarily give us this particular individual, but listen to how Matthew kind of sums up this experience here in him healing all these people in this area. He says, and they glorified the God of Israel. That's a very interesting statement. Why would Matthew say it that way? Other than the fact that Matthew perhaps is writing to the Jews and perhaps letting them see that that's the God that people are supposed to turn to. Now, if you couple that with the theological orthodoxy of Jews first, it begins to make a little more sense as to what Jesus is saying and doing here. He wants it to be known very clearly that people must come to Israel's God if they're going to get salvation. Jesus is the Messiah to the Jews, and if you want to have salvation, you have to come to that Messiah, and that Messiah's God. That God is God. So there's a very strong case to be made here that there's a theological point that both Mark and Matthew are trying to make, and that's probably it. The Messiah is going to come from Israel. Her God is the one true God that deserves praise and glory. Only He can heal. And the way Jesus goes about this, maybe are some secondary issues here, but I think still somewhat significant. So I think there are some other things that we can learn from Jesus' behavior here. I think most importantly is Jesus is kind of, let's say it this way, he's sort of intensely personal. He takes the time for individuals. Now, admittedly, he didn't want to with the woman. All right, he doesn't give her the time of day. But again, she allows him. Or he allows her to talk to them. And it's interesting, these two particular occasions, one of them's really disruptive. All right? The woman just, she's crying out to him, and the disciples are upset because she's making so much of a commotion. And they're the ones who say, Lord, just go ahead and heal her. Just get her out of here. You know, they want to get rid of her, not because they really care about her. They want to get rid of her because she's being disruptive. Okay? You know, I always love what Bill Cosby says about, you know, when kids start getting kind of rowdy. He says, parents don't want justice. Parents want quiet. You know, which I think is probably true in some cases. They just want the disruption to stop. They don't care whether the kids get justice or fairness. You know, they want quiet. The disciples just want quiet here. They don't care about her. Jesus, in a way, does really care about her because he allows her to talk to him. The second time is a little more subdued. I mean, it's literally quiet because you got a guy here who's deaf. His world is totally silent. So, but Jesus still takes him into a kind of silent environment, which I don't know if there's a reason for that, but he takes him away privately, by himself. Some way, and for some reason, it seems to be that this particular occasion needs this private moment. He needs to deal with this guy as an individual. Mark tells the story of two individuals. And I think there's something significant about that. The focus is on the individual. The focus is on them. Jesus gives them their attention that they need. He allows the woman to speak directly to him. And Mark focuses on this one deaf man while Matthew just kind of shows the big picture. Now, let me ask you a question. How do you feel when you go to your doctor and your doctor gives you all the time you need to explain what's going on? And he doesn't act like he's in a hurry to get to another appointment because it means more money for him. It makes you feel pretty good, doesn't it, when the doctor just sits and talks to you and demonstrates to you by the amount of time that he gives you that he or she really cares about your health. I think that's what you have happening here with Jesus. Okay? I think that's an observation that's not an unfair observation to make about these particular stories. These are individual people who have individual needs, and Jesus tends to them. Admittedly, one in a kind of odd way, but he does still tend to her needs, and he does give her what she needs. Now, I think there are some current applications for this kind of thinking that I think have, in kind of a way, a sort of moral application. Yeah, it may not seem that way, but I think there are a couple of areas where, you know, with issues today, we have to kind of apply that same type of thinking if we're going to come up with something reasonable to help the situation. Let's talk, first of all, a little bit about education. I'm a big fan of William Bennett. William Bennett used to be the Secretary of Education a number of decades ago, and he still writes a lot about education. He still writes a lot about sort of instilling moral values into children. And he had some interesting things to say recently about education. And one of the questions that was posed to him was this one. How can American education improve? His answer? Education gets better locally. The single most important adult in a child's life is, you should guess, the parent. The single most important thing about the education of the child needs to be the parent and the parent's attitude toward education. Not how much he or she knows, but attitude. The parent can be illiterate, not able to do any of the homework with the kid, but still saying, this is important. You turn off the TV, you do your work, you listen to the teacher. Now you see, that's specific and it's individual. That's where the answer lies, not in some big program, not in throwing money at a program. And Bennett will even say it's not in class size, it's not in throwing money at it, it's not in technology, it's not having the best technology. It's by the individual parent saying to the child, education is important. That's where education starts, And see, that gets us back to the individual, doesn't it? It gets us back to personal attention. Parents, that's why you're there. That's why God gave them to you and not to the government. He gave them to you. And you are the one that should be the one that does that. By the way, there's a second element here which is very interesting, and that's competent teachers. He says that's even more important than class size. And he says there's a ton of research on that which bears out that truth. And once again, we're talking about an individual. Admittedly, a competent individual, but that person has to be able to teach the child. And even if they're in a class of 40 or 50 or 60, and I remember being in classes of 50 plus when I was growing up, right in the heart of the baby boom. I mean, we barely had enough room to fit all the desks in the classroom. You know, I suppose you could argue it didn't do me all that good, but, you know, the fact is, you know, we still got some education. And we were still able to get the knowledge we needed. Competency in the teacher. And again, you see, it kind of goes back to the individual. How does that individual deal with the kids? And how do they perform in the classroom? Okay. So parents and competent teachers. One gives undivided attention. The other gives quality learning. If we have the choice where to send our children, wouldn't we go where the competency level has demonstrated that learning takes place? Well, I would think so. I would think so. Another area where I think this applies, and this may be a little controversial, but I think it's important for us to think about it, and that's in our healthcare system. One of the things that we may or may not be aware of in the Affordable Health Care Act, there is going to be a panel of 15 people. And you know what their one job is going to be? Holding down costs. That's their job. Now, let's just assume that you have a healthcare need, and it may even be a life and death situation. You know, will you get the healthcare you need because, you know, they can afford it or not? If they can't afford it, what are they going to say? Now, we're talking about 15 people off in a building here somewhere. I don't know whether it's going to be in Washington or wherever it's going to be, but it's going to be in a building somewhere where they're going to make a decision about your health. Now, is that detached or isn't it? Here's what one writer said about that. He said, in real life, somebody indeed has to decide whether a 95-year-old should get a $100,000 heart transplant. Somebody indeed has to decide whether and when to turn off a ventilator for someone who's been in a coma for 3 months. The question is, who makes those hard decisions? Should it not be with the individual person or with their family, with the perhaps advice of godly advisors? Their minister, their rabbi, whoever it is, their person that they believe tells them, you know, what should be the right thing to do here. Not some people who are just saying, well, it's not cost efficient. I think if you look at Jesus' life here and what he does, we're not talking about cost efficiency. We're talking about individual lives. And I think that throws a whole different thing into the discussion here. And we can even throw on top of that if we need to, and I think we should, the religious freedom issue here about us having to pay for somebody else's abortion, which we will have to pay for, depending on how the state structured this, or the fact that the religious institutions are being forced to pay for people's contraception. And whatever you think about that isn't really the point. We're talking about a religious freedom issue here. So you add that and couple that into, you know, who makes the decision here? Is there some real individual care in what goes on here? The decision should be made locally, just like the educational decisions are best done locally with the parents and with the individuals who are closest to the child or to whoever's getting the education. Jesus is intensely personal. He deals with people. He deals with their particular needs. He deals with your particular needs. Isn't that one of the things we love about Jesus? He knows me. He's intimate with me. I don't have to go to some God who doesn't know me and offer a sacrifice and hope that I can persuade him to do what I want. God knows me. What does David say in Psalm 139? You know, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. You know everything about me. Even before I was born, you knew me. That's the God that we serve. That has something to do I think with how Jesus deals with this here, Jesus is the Messiah for everyone. Although he came to a group, he ministered to everyone who came to him. And I don't really even care, you know, whether I understand why he does what he does here in Mark chapter 7. The fact is, he heals her. And we know later on that the ministry is going to go to the Gentiles, isn't it? Where he is right now among the Gentiles. The God of Israel is the sovereign ruler over all people. Let no one tell you, or let no one else tell you what is right and wrong. What's right and wrong comes from God, from his morality, from what he wants. If there's any reason for us to believe the gospel today, I think it would have to be that God cares for us as individuals. He knows our needs. He knows what your particular needs are. He knows we're sinners, and that's why he sent his son Jesus to die for us. And when we accept the gospel as Jesus died for my sins, and I take it individually to heart that I am a sinner, you see, then healing begins. And then I can accept by faith what Jesus has done for me. And not only can I accept by faith, but I can make a confession to others about that. And I can be baptized for the remission of my sins. I'm not being baptized for somebody else's sins. I'm being baptized for the remission of my sins. And that's the beauty of it. Once you come to grips with that and realize that individually, I need this, it's there for the taking. God cares about the individual. Jesus cares for you. Accept the gospel today and live with it every day of your life. Floyd, let's stand and sing.